This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. You might know our guest Keith Hernandez as a big league ball player or as a memorable guest on two episodes of Seinfeld. And if you're a New York Mets fan, you might know his cat, Haji. In 17 seasons in the big leagues, Hernandez was known for hitting wicked line drives and for dazzling defensive play at first base. He won 11 straight Gold Glove Awards, a batting title, and a National League Most Valuable Player Award on his way to two World Series championships with the St. Louis Cardinals and the Mets. His last season as a player was in 1990, but he got into broadcasting and is now a TV analyst for Mets games. He's fan-friendly, known for playing catch with kids before a game, and once working the gate at the stadium parking lot. He's also built quite a social media following, at times featuring videos with Haji, his now famous 15-year-old Bengal cat. Hernandez has a new memoir which focuses less on his glory days in the game than on times he struggled, especially when he was young and trying to adjust to big league pressure, big league pitching, and the stresses of playing every day. His new book is called I'm Keith Hernandez. Well, Keith Hernandez, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, this book is not about the two World Series you played in. I mean, some amazing exploits you had with the Cardinals and the Mets. It's a lot of it's about your struggles coming up. Why did you focus on this in the book?
Well, I wanted the book to be my struggles, and they're there. I mean, I struggled my first 2 years in the minor leagues in A-ball and Double-A. I struggled mightily in the big leagues. I was up when I was 20 years of age. I know 2.5 years removed from high school, and I struggled for those first 3 years in the major leagues. So it was no yellow brick road, and it's a story of perseverance, a dream of a young boy growing up in Northern California to be the next Mickey Mantle, a star major league player. And I stayed with it, and I didn't quit.
You know, I recently read in the new book about Tiger Woods that his dad put him in a high chair in his garage when he was like an infant and had him watch his dad taking golf swings. And then he had him swinging a golf club when he was a toddler. And I read in your book that your dad had a kind of a training rig set up in your garage for your brother and you. Tell us about that and what it meant to you.
Well, our garage in Pacifica, California, didn't have sheetrock on the ceiling, and it was just all the 2x4s and the crossbars and the beams. So, and we did have a rafter going across, was a loft, kind of like almost like an open attic. And Dad set up on the middle of the garage. My brother and I were both left-hand hitters, so he set it up more on the right side of the garage if you were looking at the door. So we can take a full swing, a rope tied around one of the 2x4s, and extended the rope down, and then put two white cotton athletic socks with a tennis ball in it, and then tied it to the rope. And the rope at full extension would be a knee-high strike. We started doing this when we were like 6, 7 years old. I mean, it was my brother and I. And then if you wanted to get it up higher to a belt high strike, you just threw the rope over the 2x4. Or if you wanted a high pitch, keep throwing it over maybe 2, 3, 4 times, and it was a high pitch. And the ball would swing like a pendulum. And it would, in the arc of the ball going up after we stroked it, would hit the underside of the loft, which was like 1x4s. So I marked them, you know, single, out, double, fly ball, and I would swing for hours and play games with that. And my dad in the beginning would watch his swing, make sure we were swinging properly, and eventually he felt that we had it down pretty good. He didn't have to watch. I remember him saying when I was older that he'd come home from work. He was a fireman in San Francisco for 30 years, and he'd hear that pounding of the tennis ball against the rafters, and it would give him a headache sometimes, but it made him laugh because I was there taking probably 500 to 1,000 swings a day. I just absolutely loved it.
Right. And your dad knew something about the game. He would look at your mechanics. Tell us a bit about him. How did he know so much about baseball?
Well, my dad was a minor league player, and he was originally drafted by the Brooklyn Dodgers before World War II. He got hit in the head his first year, and his eyes progressed. No helmets those days. Eyes progressively got worse. He eventually played for Cleveland and Oklahoma City, and then was traded to the Cardinals and played under Johnny Keen in Houston, where he met my mother, and they got married after the season. He was a very good hitter and a very fine fielding first baseman, and his career was shortened, and so he put it all after the war. He served 4 years in the service in the Navy at Pearl Harbor in a ship repair unit, played on the U.S. Navy team, which played the U.S. Army team, and the Army Air Corps, Stan Musial in 45 played with my father. Ted Williams was playing on the teams, the Marine team. So there was all these major leaguers playing in this league. We're entertaining the troops, basically.
Yeah, so it's clear you had talent, but it was all of that practice from somebody who knew what he was doing that no doubt honed your skills. You were drafted by the St. Louis Cardinals organization and were a prized prospect. A lot was expected of you, and it took years for you, as you write in the book, to really get your stride as a hitter. And partly that was, you know, adjusting mechanics and learning pitches, but a lot of it was emotional. How did your head get in the way?
Well, I describe my fragility, my emotional fragility. You come out of high school. You're a star in your little area you grew up in. I grew up with the baby boomers, and there was lots of kids to play ball with. And all of a sudden, my first spring training, there's 700 kids in camp, and there's only 8 teams. And I know I'm going to make the team. I got a bonus, signing bonus of $30,000, which was unheard of for a 42nd round pick. But the big adjustment is you play 2 games a week in summer league, and back in those days in high school. Now you're playing, I believe it was 128 game schedule in the minor league, something like that. And you're playing every day, and you're not going to hit 500 like you did in high school. And it was tough. It was depressing. And then you go in slumps, and your first experience was slumps. And it's all a learning process. And you're a hot-headed 18-year-old kid. And you don't know how to handle. You throw helmets, you throw bats, you kick dirt, and you got coaches trying to tell you to calm down, and you got to learn to play this game on an even keel. And it's all part of the process. That's what the minor leagues are about. But it takes a long time, and everybody's different. It took me a lot longer.
Tell us the story of the first time you met guys razzing you in the stands, some college kids in a minor league game.
It was, I was 18, my first year in ball, making $500 a month and only getting paid during the season. And, you know, you went home and you didn't get paid. And we played a doubleheader, a very windy game in St. Petersburg, Florida, in the Florida State League. And it was a pop-up. And I dropped it. And, you know, to me, I drop a pop-up. And there were some college kids that had come down to watch the game, and they were sitting over on the first base side. And I guess they read that I was the big prospect, and they just started riding me incessantly. And as a result, I got tighter and tighter, and I got madder and madder, and I didn't acknowledge them, because that's asking for trouble. I had enough sense to realize that. But they were relentless, and then it turned out that another play later in the second game, I just made another botch on an easy throw. It was obviously they got under my skin. And when the game was over, Roy Matica was my manager. And I'm 18, he calls me in the office. And obviously he's going to tell me, hey, you can't let, you know, he's going to give me the lessons. And I just start crying. And he just had Roy was a cigarette smoking, he had a cigarette in his hand and beer in his other hand. And I remember him going, oh, geez. And there I was completely after, you know, all that pent up emotion inside. It just came out in tears.
I think you write at one point that one of your coaches thought you needed to be away from your dad a little bit. I mean, he was such an important influence in your life. Was he, a challenge, a burden? Was it difficult with him, too?
Well, when the Cardinals were scouting me, Dad negotiated my contract. They got a sense of the strength of the power of my father. Bob Kennedy kept me out of the California State League, which he felt I was ready to play in because that was the top A-ball league. And he put me in the middling Florida State League, which was a tough league. And he told me years later he wanted to kind of cut the apron strings from my father. So there you go, Bob Kennedy being a real influence on my career.
What, do you think you needed to cut the strings from your father a bit?
Yes, no question. It was the right thing to do. Because Dad, my brother played in the California State League, and Dad came to all his games just whenever he could. And that would have drove me crazy. Gary had a different relationship with my father than I did. And yes, it was the right thing to do to get me away from him and get me to stand up on my own 2 feet.
Was he hypercritical? You felt like you just couldn't please him?
He coached us all through Little League, and he was just wonderful. And the parents and the kids were all benefited from his instruction. And he was really terrific with the kids. But once I got into high school, he was so petrified that a coach would ruin me. And it was, in other words, he lost control. And that's when things started to get a little dicey between me and him. He would always watch whenever he can. He was a fireman. He worked 24 hours off 48. He had 2 days off. So he would be at every practice in high school watching. I mean, it was like, the central scrutinizer, from Frank Zappa's Joe's Garage album. And it was just like forever watching. And I would feel that it was like a shroud over me. And I would come home on pins and needles. I didn't know if I would, get laid into or he would smile and praise me. It was kind of a tough situation.
And that continued into your major league career too, right?
Yes, it did.
I'm sure he was a great guy. And he died in 1992, right?
He did, ironically, 1 year after my retirement. It was too bad he couldn't have lived longer.
Well, when I told people I was going to be interviewing Keith Hernandez, everybody says, you got to ask him about Seinfeld. You were a story on Seinfeld for an episode. How did that happen?
I was a year and a half, I believe, into retirement and just sitting around wondering what the heck I'm going to do with the second half of my life in New York City. And my final last agent was Scott Boris. And I get a call from Scott, which I hadn't talked to anymore. I'm not playing ball. He's not negotiating any contracts for me. And he goes, well, there's this sitcom that they want you to come out and do an episode in L.A. Just got a call. And I go, well, what's the name of the episode? And it was Seinfeld. Now, we're baseball players. We play night games. Prime times, we're in the middle of the game in prime time. I don't watch prime time TV, even to this day. I had no idea what Seinfeld was. I think it was 2 years into the show. It hadn't really taken off. And I said, well, okay. I go, how much would they pay me? And he goes, well, they're going to pay you $15,000. They'll fly you out first class and back. You're there for a week in L.A. They're going to put you up at a real nice hotel. And I think you're just going to have minimal lines and just, a little spot. And I said, okay, I'll do it. Well, that was decided on Friday. I was supposed to be in L.A. for 7 a.m. call on Monday to start rehearsal for that episode, which would run all week, the rehearsals. And they FedExed Saturday night delivery, the script. And I get the script, and I'm realizing that I am not a bit player. I am a guest star, and the episode revolves around me. And I've got a ton of lines, and actually, the one scene in it where it's almost like a soliloquy. I mean, it was 2.5 pages of dialogue, and I'm like petrified. I had no desire to act. I had no training to act. And all of a sudden, I was just thrust into this, thrown into the water, and see if I can sink or swim. And I was petrified. So that's how it happened.
What were they like working with, Seinfeld and Jason Alexander and the others?
Well, the thing was, Jerry is a Brooklynite and a Met fan, and I was his favorite player. So he conceived this show. Larry David is a Yankee fan. So they conceived the show. It was all Jerry's idea. And when I got there, I was, introduced to everybody. They were all wonderful. Jerry was very shy, in the beginning, and the
like other you're the celebrity,
actors.
Right?
Yes, and there the other principal actors were just laughing, come up to me and going, "Jerry's never like this. I can't believe it. He's like he's like starstruck." I'm going, so yeah, we go through rehearsal, and Michael Richards didn't know anything about baseball and was very inquisitive. He asked me questions about baseball, my profession. He was very curious about it. Julia was, I believe, 3 months pregnant with her first child, and she was lovely. Jason was a little bit, I almost felt like he said, "Well, look at this guy. I worked my butt off and went through acting school, and it took me a long time to get a break, and look at this guy. He's got a guest star role." That's what that was my perception. He wasn't nasty, but he was just kind of a little standoffish. And he didn't really, he shook my hand after we did Friday night. We did a run-through for the NBC executives, the censors. And I did not mess up the entire show. It was an hour show. And when it was over, he came up to me with a big smile and shook my hand and said, "Nice going." And I guess I passed the test. But it was a great experience. The creative process was wonderful. That's what I took out of it. How in the beginning they had the script. And they had three other writers. You had Larry David. You had Jerry. And you sat at a rectangular table. Everybody had a script. And everybody had an input. "Let's try this. Let's try that." And then Larry David would obviously have the ultimate say whether they would use it or not. But the creative process as the week went on to make the show better, I thought was just fascinating.
When I watched it again, I realized there are actually three distinct plot lines. There's Jerry meets you, and he wants you to call him and is disappointed when you don't. There's this bromance. And then there's this thing about how you had allegedly spit on Kramer and Newman before. Yes. And there's like a, it's like a Zapruder Kennedy assassination film kind of mock-up. And then the other one is you date Elaine. And I thought we would just hear the scene where you've gone out and you're saying goodnight, and the question is, are you going to kiss her? And we hear kind of the thought bubbles for each character as you're talking. Let's listen.
"Well, thanks for a nice evening. This was really fun."
"Yeah, it was.
Gosh, should I kiss her goodnight?
Is he going to try and kiss me? I love Cajun cooking."
"Really? You know, my mom's one quarter Cajun."
"Oh, my father's half drunk."
"Maybe they should get together."
"Go ahead, kiss her. I'm a baseball player, damn it."
"What's he waiting for? I thought he was a cool guy."
"Come on, I won the MVP in 79. I can do whatever I want to."
"Well, this is getting awkward."
"Well, good night."
"Good night." "Who does this guy think he is?"
"I'm Keith Hernandez."
And that's the name of his book. I'm Keith Hernandez, our guest.
You're embarrassing me.
Yeah, there's a nice long kiss at the end, and you say, "I'm Keith Hernandez." You know, you've also developed a huge social media following. This is interesting because, you know, your old ball players are not known for taking to things like this. And I thought we'd listen to just a minute of a Twitter video that you put out.
Sure.
We see you with your cat Haji on your left shoulder, and you've just gotten up and you're walking out to get a paper. Let's listen to just a little bit of this.
"All right, Haji and I are going to go get the paper. Let's go, Haji. I look like I've been in a train wreck, but that's okay. Haji, let's go. You like this cool weather. Look at you. Yeah, Mother Nature. There you go. Look at that, Haji. Yeah, let's go get the papers."
And it's about as exciting as it sounds like. So that video has 266,000 views, and a lot of people say, "Haji, your cat is the star." Just tell us a little bit about Haji and what kind of relationship you have with him, particularly given that you have to be on the road so much.
Well, number one, I'm not married, so I can't have a dog. It would be very unfair to the dog. In my second marriage, I got married in 06, was married around 6 years, together with her around 9 years. She had two cats, and we decided to get a third cat. And he's a Bengal, which is he's high-bred. It costs a pretty penny. He's been with me 15 years. When we got divorced, we had a big dog too. I couldn't have the big dog, and so Haji came with me. He was my favorite, and he's been with me for 15 years. We're buddies. I grew up with dogs and cats in Northern California, in a very agrarian surroundings, on a beach town in Lindemar Beach, California, Pacifica. So he's been my buddy, and he's very demanding. He's almost like a dog. I mean, he's just a part of me, and I love him dearly. I'm a cat lover.
And he's a star on a lot of these videos, isn't he?
He is, and it's demanding. My followers want me to do videos of him. When the Mets go bad, it's just hilarious. It's just, oh, I'm so depressed. They've lost three in a row, and the same old Mets. Can you just get me through this little dry spell? Well, send me a video of Haji. So I find myself doing videos with Haji. And the people,
he's a therapy
just,
cat for Mets fans.
He eats it up. He exactly. I didn't think of it that way. You got a point.
Great. I'm not enough of a baseball geek to really know what Hall of Fame numbers look like, but I mean, you've won 11 straight Gold Gloves. You were a career 296 hitter with 162 home runs. You had a batting title, an MVP award, two World Series rings. Why aren't you in the Hall of Fame?
Well, my father, I was a really, really good athlete, and I used to be able to run pretty good, not fast, but above average. And I stole 19 bases in 1982. Home runs mean a lot. I played in St. Louis. It was 386 in the gaps. It was 335 down the lines.
Big park.
It was a huge park.
Yeah.
So the 162 home runs, whatever it is, you know, if I had played at Wrigley Field, or if I had played at Veterans Stadium, or Three Rivers Stadium, I probably would have hit over 200 home runs, and that would have helped, which means more RBI. I drove in over 1,000 runs. So I lost some time playing with two strikes and two lockouts. You know, those are games that went across the board that I wasn't able to play.
Does it bother you that you're not in the Hall?
No, I tell you what, when it's all said and done and I'm long gone, who's going to remember? I'm not going to worry about it. What bothers me the most, Dave, is my 300 lifetime batting average. I'm at 296. And ironically, my childhood idol, born on the same birthday as him, Mickey Mantle, October 20th, when I got my first baseball card and I saw that, he was my idol. I always had a 7 on my back. That is Mickey's pet peeve. I read in his biography that he lost because of injury. He stayed around too long. He lost his 300 lifetime batting average. And ironically, I'm in the same boat. I'm a 300 hitter. I'm not a 296 hitter.
Keith Hernandez, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
I can't thank you enough for having me.
Keith Hernandez played 17 seasons in the big leagues and is now a color analyst for New York Mets games. His new memoir is called I'm Keith Hernandez. The supernatural horror thriller Hereditary scared audiences silly at the recent Sundance Film Festival, where it had journalists invoking classics like Rosemary's Baby, The Exorcist, and The Shining. Hereditary stars Toni Collette, Gabriel Byrne, and Anne Dowd, and was written and directed by Ari Aster. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
Hereditary is the most emotionally devastating horror movie I've seen in ages. Or maybe it's the scariest family drama I've seen in ages. The sensationally talented writer-director Ari Aster knows that what upsets us and what terrifies us are often one and the same. His masterful debut feature will tie your stomach in knots even before all hell breaks loose. It's a searing portrait of grief, of a family slowly coming apart as one tragedy follows another. It also has a brilliant lead performance from Toni Collette as Annie, a professional artist who is about to bury her 78-year-old mother, Ellen, as the movie opens. It appears to be no great loss. As Annie notes at the funeral, and later at a support group meeting, Ellen could be an intensely private, difficult, and demanding woman. In the days that follow, Annie tries to move on, focusing on her work and her family. In a way, her work is her family. She builds and paints intricate dioramas, miniature dollhouse versions of her own woodside home, each one reconstructing a key moment from her past. Annie has two kids with her supportive but somewhat low-key husband, Steve, played by Gabriel Byrne. Their son, Peter, played by Alex Wolff, is like a lot of teenage boys, bored, inattentive, interested mainly in sex and pot. He's better adjusted than his younger sister, Charlie, an odd, withdrawn 13-year-old played by Millie Shapiro from the Broadway musical Matilda. Charlie likes to draw creepy pictures of animals in her notebook, and walks around in an orange sweatshirt that reminded me of the red-hooded killer from the 1973 horror classic Don't Look Now, one of many obvious touchstones here. As Annie points out before bedtime one night, Charlie was unusually close to her grandmother.
You know you were her favorite, right? Even when you were a little baby, she wouldn't let me feed you because she needed to feed you. She was going crazy.
She wanted me to be a boy.
You know, I was a tomboy when I was growing up. I hated dresses and dolls and pink.
Who's gonna take care of me?
Excuse me, you don't think I'm gonna take care of you?
But when you die.
The mystery in Hereditary concerns the precise nature of Ellen's legacy. It's a movie about the good and the bad, but mostly the bad, that we end up passing on to our descendants. When Annie looks through her mother's boxes, she finds a few books on spiritualism and the occult. She also finds a letter that her mother has left for her, containing the ominous sentence, "Our sacrifice will pale next to the rewards." I wouldn't dream of revealing what that sacrifice turns out to be. Suffice to say that all four of the central characters are swiftly plunged into a waking nightmare so cruel and so vivid that it takes your breath away. Astor has some fun playing with genre conventions. There are strange noises, eerie lighting tricks, candlelit seances, and hair-raising dream sequences. Annie is befriended by a concerned older woman who, as played by Anne Dowd of The Handmaid's Tale, is clearly bad news. But Hereditary is no cheap exercise in jolts. The pacing is slow and deliberate, the surprises in no hurry to reveal themselves. As Annie and her loved ones move through their personal stages of grief, you get the sense that they are not just enacting the rituals of the bereaved, but that they are being manipulated, like chess pieces, by forces beyond their comprehension. The cinematographer, Pavel Pogorzelski, often frames the actors from a distance in long shots, reducing them to the scale of Annie's dolls. Those dioramas, which once served as a therapeutic outlet for Annie, become a striking metaphor for her family's entrapment. But if the characters are shackled, the actors are fully liberated. Alex Wolff is heartbreaking as Peter, who is in some ways the story's most anguished victim. He's an unformed mass of guilt and resentment, and he internalizes each emotional blow as only an alienated teenager can. But the movie belongs to Toni Collette. This is her first major return to horror since her Oscar-nominated work in The Sixth Sense nearly 20 years ago, and it's been a long time coming. Collette plays Annie like an instrument going slowly out of tune, exposing more and more nerve endings in every scene. It's one of the most emotionally fine-grained performances I've seen this year, a mesmerizing reminder that the devil really is in the details.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. Coming up, we'll hear from actor Nick Offerman. Best known as Ron Swanson on Parks and Recreation, he's now starring in the new film Hearts Beat Loud. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. You might know our guest, actor Nick Offerman, from his role as Ron Swanson in the sitcom Parks and Recreation. You might say Ron's a man's man.
Fishing relaxes me. It's like yoga, except I still get to kill something.
Offerman's had supporting roles in many TV series and films, including The Founder, about the origins of the McDonald's chain, and the second season of the FX series Fargo. Offerman stars in a new film called Hearts Beat Loud. He plays a middle-aged man who owns a struggling record store in Brooklyn. He's also a single dad. His daughter is a star student who's graduated high school and is headed to UCLA. They're both musicians, and they sometimes jam together in the evening. In this scene, he's interrupted his daughter, Sam, played by Kiersey Clemons, who's studying.
Did you, find my birth certificate?
Hello, dear dad. It's going great. How are you?
I'm serious. I need it for enrollment. They keep sending me those emails.
I know we hung on to your umbilical cord. I think I know where that is.
You're not funny. Not even, like, a little bit.
I'll look for it tomorrow.
You smell like cigarettes.
That might be my new Axe body spray scent, Brothel. What are you doing, homework?
We're studying the heart this week.
I hope you're hanging out with friends or something later, at least.
They're all away for the summer.
I just can't believe you're spending your last summer before college in a pre-med class right before you have to go spend 4 years taking pre-med classes. By which I mean I'm very proud of your work ethic.
Do you know how hard it is for an incoming freshman to get a research position?
No.
I'm being prepared. Plus, I enjoy this. This is fun for me.
Well, it's clearly got you in a terrific mood.
Can I help you with something, or?
Yeah. Are you not watching the clock? It's jam sesh time.
No.
Come on.
That's our guest Nick Offerman with Kiersey Clemons in the new film Hearts Beat Loud. Well, Nick Offerman, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on this film, Hearts Beat Loud. You know, it's not often you see the dad playing, hey, what are you doing, studying?
Yeah.
You're in a role here that you haven't done in real life, which is being a dad of a teenager. And you, at least on the roles that most of us have seen, have played a lot of characters who are sort of, you know, colorful cranks. But this role has a lot of range. I mean, this guy has a lot of pain. Did it feel good to, I mean, I know you've done a lot of different, more varied roles in theater that most of us haven't seen. Did it feel good to be in a film kind of confronting all those different challenging emotions?
Absolutely. First of all, I can't wait to tell my folks that you said I play colorful cranks. I'm tickled pink by that description. But yeah, there are specifically just getting to play a fully fleshed out human being. You know, this is the largest role by far I've ever had in a film. And so by nature of having this vulnerable relationship with my landlady, who I'd like to be my romantic partner in Toni Collette, and this relationship with my daughter, played by Kiersey, I just got to play all these scenes that I had never gotten to do in 25 years in the business. The scene where I've had a little bit to drink and I'm on Tony's doorstep, you know, basically saying, will you please like me, which is at the heart of any film romance. Every take, we would stop the scene and I would say, you guys, I feel like a freshman at prom. I've never gotten to just do a scene like this, a boy asking a girl if she'll love him. So it was thrilling.
People best know you probably for playing Ron Swanson in the series Parks and Recreation, which ran 7 seasons, right, on NBC. So let's talk about Parks and Recreation. Ron Swanson is the guy you play. I saw a piece in Chicago Magazine that described him as a dyspeptic, government-hating Luddite with a heart of gold. Let's give listeners a taste of him. This is a scene where you, as Ron Swanson, are getting some medical treatment, and the nurse, who's Anne, played by Rashida Jones, is trying to get you to provide some basic health information. Let's listen.
I'd like to object again to being brought here against my will.
Okay, I'm just going to double-check your form here. Ron, you redacted all the information.
I answered some of them.
For date of birth, you wrote springtime.
Which is true.
Everything you write down is confidential. We need you to give real answers.
Fine.
How many drinks of alcohol do you consume a week?
One.
That's it? One drink?
One shelf.
Do you exercise?
Yes. Lovemaking and woodworking.
Do you have any history of mental illness in your family?
I have an uncle who does yoga.
Allergies?
Cowardice and weak-willed men. And hazelnuts.
Sexual history?
Epic and private.
Okay. I'm gonna go get your doctor. He's a rude, brash jerk. You'll love him.
And that's our guest, Nick Offerman, with Rashida Jones in Parks and Recreation. You grew up in Manuka, Illinois. What was your childhood like? What kind of kid were you?
Well, my childhood was incredibly idyllic, made so much more so by living in modern urban life. I mean, at the time, I was part of a big family. I still am. You know, there are over 30 of them, and they all live within an eight-mile radius in this small town. The nucleus of the family was my mom's side, a corn and soybean farm that also had pigs through my high school years. And so growing up around that family and working on the farm with them and learning to use tools from my dad and learning to cook and, you know, basically live in a 70s and 80s version of Little House on the Prairie with a terrific mom and dad. There was a lot of sports. It was an incredibly good time. And it instilled in me a work ethic. It gave me the ability to have a good time, even if the weather is lousy or we don't have enough ingredients to make everybody a sandwich. My family taught me to still figure out how to get a laugh out of it, and that has served me incredibly well in all walks of life. But my town was very small and white and conservative, and so as soon as I got to theater school, I said, oh, okay, the world is vast and multicolored, and I get it now, you know, America and the world are made up of all these different colors and creeds and so forth of people, and I want to be part of this.
I know you got into acting at college at the University of Illinois at Urbana. Is that where it was?
Yeah.
Right. And you built sets at the same time for some of the production. Was that a way to get parts before you'd sort of developed your acting chops?
Yeah, it was. I mean, in the 4 years of theater school, it became clear that I was not going to be cast well. And it was well-deserved. I was trying too hard. I hadn't figured out the sort of foundational secret of acting, which is, I think Ringo sings, just act naturally. I think I unwittingly thought that my sort of country rube persona would not be interesting, you know, to an audience. I needed to be much more cooler and hip and urbane. And so I just tried way too hard, which made me bad. Meanwhile, one of the classes we had to take as freshmen was scene shop. We took costume shop and lighting. And in the scene shop, that was my first real wood shop. And it might as well have been the land of Oz. I mean, I just was immediately smitten. I knew how to use tools. I had worked framing houses. I'd built a lot of stuff with my dad, including a small barn. And I picked up the tools and I hammered them together. And the rest of the class stood there staring at me with their jaws dropped. And they said, where in the world did you learn to use that thing? And of course, I was astonished that all these kids had never swung a hammer before. But the guy running the shop said, hey, you can make wages in here. You know, in your off time, you can come in and I'll pay you to use these tools and I'll teach you to use the shop. And so that organically became my formula where everybody saw that and they said, hey, let's not give Nick too many lines because of the bad acting, but let's throw him a bone because then he'll build the whole damn set. And so I exploited that circumstance for years, and it really paid off. They kept me around, and, you know, five lines became six. 1 year I had 9 lines. That was a big year for me. And then eventually, you know, the penny dropped, and I said, oh, I should just talk like me. and then things began to pick up.
I know you went to Chicago and spent a lot of time in theater there and worked with some really talented and creative people and have got a reputation for doing good work. And then you decided to move to L.A., where you kind of left your Chicago theater reputation behind and had to go to auditions where people didn't necessarily know or care about that. In your book, Paddle Your Own Canoe, you have a great chapter about auditions. How did you learn You know, I don't know how to market yourself. What casting directors were looking for? What not to do in an audition?
Boy, that's a big question. It was absolutely a leap of faith, and I say this is not false modesty. I had a very healthy amount of ignorance that allowed me to safely make leaps like this, and so it took me a while to figure out in auditions. My work generally is merit-based. I'm not the kind of guy to come into your office and you say, wow, the panache on this guy. We better sign him up before he goes down the street and Paramount gets him. But the thing that's hard to conquer is you're a broke actor. Every single job, you know, it can be a guest star job on some terrible TV show, but it will change your life. Like, if you get it, it will pay for 6 months of rent. And so that lends a desperation to your audition. And that's the secret to the whole thing, is learning to conquer that sensibility. And I could never fake it. I did my best to, you know, be nonchalant and shrug and say, hi, you know, my name's Nick, who cares? Let's take a swing at this thing. I didn't know this was the formula, but I decided to quit auditioning for commercials. That was one thing. I just added the hours that I'd spent auditioning for commercials versus if I had been paid as a carpenter for those hours. And I was like, oh, that was really stupid. I would have made, you know, another several thousand dollars. And so I quit doing commercials and focused on my tool, working with my tools and my hands. The other thing was, I said, I don't care if it's not a theater town. I got to do a play. That's my manhood is founded upon creating theater. And so I looked all around, and some great friends of mine, these casting directors, put me in a play. They hooked me up with this play, the lead of which was Megan Mullally. And I mean, I was low. I was drinking too much bourbon. I was having a real tough time. And I got into this play because I had a feeling, and sure enough, it saved my life. I met my wife, and she had just finished two seasons of Will and Grace. So she was flying high. She was on top.
And you didn't know, right?
Well, I didn't. I was living in an unfinished basement. I didn't have a TV. So I knew of Will and Grace because you have to know what's going on in case you get an audition for it. But I had never seen it. And so within the space of that play, my life changed. Our relationship began, and I focused on working as a carpenter and this incredible new love relationship. And suddenly, going into these auditions, because my life was happy, that's where I found the nonchalance. And you can't plan it. You can't go searching for that, because you won't find the right spouse, or you won't find that Zen place, or at least I didn't have the faculties to do so. But by backing into it accidentally, I suddenly realized that my auditions were so much more confident because it wasn't a matter of life or death.
You weren't desperate anymore. Yeah.
No, I knew I was going to go home and get kissed either way.
We've mentioned that, you know, you've done woodworking, but you have a commercial wood shop with a staff of, you know what, half a dozen people. The website says you focus on handcrafted traditional joinery and sustainable slab rescue, working with fallen trees from throughout Northern California and our urban LA environment. Carving spoons, chainsaw stumps, plank canoes. We keep our chisels sharp with stones, build pinball machines, and fine furniture. This is a real thing. You really spend time there, don't you?
Oh, yes. I started my shop. I actually rented the real estate 18 years ago. And at first I was alone, you know. I made commission furniture pieces on my own. And I'm very self-taught, so I would try to learn something new with each commission, to the point where, you know, I became pretty decent at particularly slab tables in the style of George Nakashima. And so when Parks and Rec began, I was on the phone with the writers when we were developing the character, and I kept saying, sorry, I'm at the shop, let me turn off the table saw or what have you. And the third time they said, hang on, now what is this shop? And I said, oh, it's my wood shop, et cetera. and they all piled on a bus and came over and looked at it, and they said, what if we make Ron a woodworker? I mean, they looked at my life and said, we think we can wring a great comedy out of what you take so seriously. And I said, that would be fine. And so when that happened, I knew from living with Megan that if this show went, and I had a feeling it was going to go, that I'd have a lot less shop time. And so that's when I began to populate Offerman Woodshop and turned it into a bit of a collective. And now it's a full-blown outfit where, you know, four or five or six young people are making a living, and it's really fun. And, you know, it's, for me, it always gets a laugh, but when people say, wow, your shop is really neat, or I love your woodworking, my knee-jerk response is, it keeps me out of the pub. And they laugh, and I say, I mean, it's a charming thing to say, but it's the absolute truth. I mean, I'm very human, and left to my own devices, I'm a hedonist, and, you know, if somebody says, hey, you know, no school today, I say, well, let's go to the bar. There's a Cubs game on, or, you know, whatever. And so I'm so grateful. I learned a long time ago that by making things with my hands, the obsession and the satisfaction in that act creates a much healthier but commensurate amount of dopamine and pleasurable sensation as drinking three pints, and it's much better for my waistline.
Nick Offerman, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
I'm such a big fan of your show. Thanks so much for having me.
Nick Offerman stars with Kiersey Clemons in the new film Hearts Beat Loud. He and Amy Poehler will host a 6-episode craft competition TV series featuring people who paint, draw, and work in fabric, metal, and wood. It's called Making It, and it premieres July 31st on NBC. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Challoner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.